And our sermon text is found this day in 2 Corinthians 5, 6 to 10. That should be well worn in your Bibles by now, huh? Page 966 in your pew Bible. Second Corinthians 5, verses 6 to 10. So we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please Him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. Courage. Be of good courage, brothers and sisters, today. That's our title, Courage. And as I reflected on this, I thought of one of my favorite recent characters from history. The stage had been set by the Allies for the invasion of France on the Normandy coast, June 6, 1944. The Higgins boats chugged towards Omaha Beach, filled with American soldiers. The skies had been swept clear of German aircraft by American fighter pilots. Army Rangers had stormed the cliffs at Pointe du Hoc. Seth will correct me on that pronunciation if I got that wrong. To capture the guns that overlooked Omaha Beach, and the Army Air Corps had ostensibly bombed the German positions that had corridors of interlocking fire over the beaches. But little did they know that not one bomb had fallen on those positions, but far inland. And as the Higgins boats dropped their ramps, German machine gun fire strafed the men pouring out. Some men jumped over the side of the landing craft and promptly sank and drowned from the weight of their gear. Many of the men cowered in fear behind the steel tank traps put there by the Germans, but were cut down anyway. And ahead of them lay 300 yards of open beach, laced with obstacles and mines in these merciless corridors of interlocking fire by the deadly German machine gun, the MG-42. Fired a 7.9-millimeter round at a rate of 1,500 per minute. It was one of the most feared weapons of World War II. All other machine guns, Allied or Axis, had this distinctive report, tat, 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 right? The MG-42, on the other hand, fired so many rounds in succession that Allied soldiers who faced it said it sounded not like a tat, 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 but like somebody tearing a sheet. Zip. Now, there's nothing more satisfying to your side than filling the air with your lead, and nothing more fearsome to the other side than knowing the air is filled with your enemy's lead. Soldiers who stormed the beaches of Normandy that day faced these withering, interlocking corridors of fire from the MG-42. That's why there were so many casualties, why soldiers off the Higgins boats hesitated on the shore, why even soldiers who made it to 300 yards over the beaches cowered at the foot of the dunes, just yards from the German pillboxes that were now firing down on them. Well into the morning, Allied generals considered calling off the assault on Omaha Beach. Others were going better, but this disaster developing on Omaha Beach made slow progress, high casualties. Meanwhile, one general, this is one of my new favorite heroes, Norman Dutch Cota, didn't hurt that he had the nickname Dutch either. Well, General Cota saw what was transpiring, so he ordered his boat to be grounded on the beach. And he began walking upright amidst heavy fire, pushing his men inland. Three of his men were cut down the moment their boat landed. And all around him, others were dropping, but he continued to push his men the 300-yard inland to the dunes. And there the offensive stalled. It's one thing to have an MG-42 firing at you from 300 yards away. It's another one to have it firing directly down on you 30 feet away. So they were trapped, they were dying, and all seemed lost. But little by little, one by one, these scattered forces were dying. So this general, Norman Dutch Cotha, finally said in desperation, "Gentlemen, we are being killed on the beaches. Let us go inland and be killed." With that, they blew holes in the barbed wire with Bangalore torpedoes, rushed through and up the beach ravines, and finally stormed the German MG-42 pillboxes. Now, this is all simple to recount and say it right here in the safety and the comfort of a church sanctuary, isn't it? It's another to actually do and perform. Aristotle said, "We become brave by doing acts." We become brave by doing acts. Not necessarily how we feel, but what we do. On that day, General Norman Dutch Cotha became a hero by doing brave acts. Fulfill the definition of courage, also defined by Aristotle, as knowing what to fear, fearing it, and yet standing one's ground against it. Knowing what to fear, it's not being fearless, indeed, but it's controlling that fear. Knowing what to fear, fearing it, and yet standing one's ground against it. Cotha added one ingredient to this formula, not only standing one's ground, but assaulting it offensively, right? Courage, then. This has direct application to your life and my life. Because courage is a great intangible that is evidenced not only on the battlefield, but in everyday mundane life, isn't it? The mother who decides to birth and nurture and raise the child born to her from a father who has maybe abandoned the family instead of aborting that child. No, she births, nurtures, and raises it. That takes courage, doesn't it? Or the young man who struggles with homosexual yearnings, perhaps, who nevertheless wages a spiritual war against them, knowing they are contrary to God's will, despite the call of his society to follow them, right? That takes courage. Spiritual courage. The alcoholic, perhaps, who finally faces his sin and addiction and turns to fight it. That takes courage as well. And for young people too, as you come into your maturity, I have this great little poem by Phoebe Carey, Our Heroes. And she writes, "Here's a hand to the boy who has courage to do what he knows to be right. When he falls in the way of temptation, he has a hard battle to fight. Who strives against self and his comrades will find a most powerful foe. All honor to him if he conquers. A cheer for the boy who says no. There's many a battle fought daily the world knows nothing about." Isn't that a good line? That's true of all of us, isn't it? "There's many a battle fought daily the world knows nothing about. There's many a brave little soldier whose strength puts a legion to rout. And he who fights sin single-handed is more of a hero, I say, than he who leads soldiers into battle and conquers by arms and the fray. Be steadfast, my boy, when you're tempted to do what you know to be right. Stand firm by the colors of manhood, and you will o'ercome in the fight. The right be your battle cry ever in waging the warfare of life, and God, who knows who are the heroes, will give you the strength for the strife." Our heroes. Great little, very applicable to what we're talking about today. And there is here a spiritual courage that the apostle recognizes for us today in our text, in these verses before us. Let's turn to them briefly. Well, relatively briefly. Briefly on my part. I was in a retreat with some of the leaders of the church yesterday and was commenting on an article we were reading, how brief it was, and somebody said, "Brief." 28-page brief for me. So, let's turn to some brief remarks, shall we? Verses 6 through 8. Courage. At home or away, we are strong because we walk by faith, not by sight. We are strong because we walk by faith, not by sight. We're in an extended argument here that Paul is bringing before the Corinthians, largely in defense of his ministry. And here, in these verses before us, Paul draws a conclusion from his previous rationale. That is, since we have an eternal abode with Christ in heaven, no matter what transpires here below, therefore we are always of good courage. That's a perfectly apt translation there, good courage. If you are assured of life, no matter what death may throw at you, why should you fear any momentary distraction? If you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the very second you die, you will pass into a state far better and more glorious than the one you are now in, why should you fear? In fact, why should you not eagerly desire that state of being? Paul does. He can so taste of that state that he can unequivocally declare, we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. Right? He makes that vivid, doesn't he, throughout all of his letters? It should be the expectation of every Christian, really. For me to live as Christ and to die as gain, as we saw in our New Testament reading today. That is, while we live in this realm, we serve Christ and his people. But when we are translated into that heavenly realm, we are with him in a way we are not now. Now, Paul expresses this eloquently in a device of the day, a chiasm. You have an example of it in your bulletin, in the outline portion of your bulletin. You see there, I hope you're getting accustomed to these by now. You see the chiasm, chi, the Greek word for the X that you see there. And then plotted on either tine of the key, you see the parallels. At home in the body, at home with the Lord. You see on the northwest and the southeast bar of the key there, and there, or away from the Lord, away from the body. You see they are parallel on the other tine of the key. This is a device that the ancients used quite often because it helped the memory, helped people retain what Paul was writing or what any ancient author might be writing at the time, a chiasm. And note the significant pause, however, in the middle, for we walk by faith, not by sight, from verse 7, right? We walk by faith, not by sight. So we have two significant venues mentioned here, at home and away. With spring training in full swing, that's why I asked about the Orioles. Opening day for the Tigers is Thursday as well. I thought of maybe titling this section, At Home or Away? The Tigers open on Thursday. But I don't think that would probably pass muster. I might be brought up on charges for that. So Paul contrasts these two respective venues, the body and the Lord. Whether we are at one or the other depends on our place in redemptive history and the Lord's own sweet time. Whether it's he's calling you in your own personal destiny before him, or whether he is concluding all things in the regeneration of creation and his return. While we are at home in the body, relatively speaking, since it's not intended to be our permanent dwelling, but while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. The Greek verb that he employs is of great interest here. Ek demeo, to leave one's country, to be an exile in a strange land. That's how it's employed in the Greek language and how it's meant to be contextualized here as well. Ek demeo. It is a verb of pilgrimage, a theme that Paul and his fellow Israelites would know very well, wouldn't they? Philo the Jew also uses this extensively when he traveled abroad too. And it's aptly employed here. The Septuagint uses this verb as well. Thy statutes, David exclaims, thy statutes have been my song in the house of my pilgrimage. Euphemism, of course, for life in the body. Howdy, pilgrim. Who used to say that all the time, right? Howdy, pilgrim. John Wayne, of course. Presently, dear believer, dear pilgrim, you are on sojourn towards the heavenly city with a task before you. Paul's was his ministry amongst the Gentiles as their apostle. What is yours? What is your task? Do you know yours as certainly as did Paul? Mine is apostle to the Idahoans, maybe. Maybe I should presume the title apostle, though. Minister to the Idahoans, perhaps. I know my purpose. I know my task. Do you know yours? God has called us all to ministry, to a task. And as long as you dwell in this tent, right, as to employ the metaphor Paul has been using throughout this chapter, as long as you dwell in your tent, and you're outfitted too, I guarantee you are outfitted in this tent, howsoever comfortable or miserable you may be in it. Some of us don't like camping, do we? Some of us don't like being... I love being in the outdoors, love camping, even bivouacking when I have to. But inside every Christian should be the inner ache for home. The inner ache for home. The desire to return to one's loved ones. Is this the case with you, dear listener? Or are you entirely comfortable in your present circumstances? That should be a yellow flag for you. Those of you who travel as part of your woka, as part of your calling, you know this well, don't you? You know this well. You arise early after traveling over land and air and sea to get to your client and report to your job site or the client's office. You give your full focus to your work. Perhaps 8, 10, 12 hours later, you collapse in your hotel room. Maybe you call home and get some sleep. Yet wherever you are, whatever you're doing, there's a part of your heart and your consciousness that aches and whispers, can't wait to get home. Perhaps some of your colleagues do not share your sentiments and feel as you do. Maybe they're having miserable circumstances at home. Maybe they're glad to be traveling, using the time away for boozing and drugs and extramarital affairs. There's plenty of those out there, but not you. Inside you ache, and outside you smile. Outside you smile. Just ask John McNeely about this. And you tell your clients and your colleagues, you have to stay here, but I get to go back to Idaho. Think of how this is multiplied in the life of those on pilgrimage for years. Israel sojourned in the wilderness 40 years, some of them comfortable in their circumstances, others aching for the promised land. Israel sojourned in exile in Babylon for 70 years. There on the willows we hung up our harps, Psalm 137 says. In exile, for the days of the land, as it rested for the time she disobeyed in refusing to observe the years of Jubilee. Some were comfortable in exile. Others ached for the shuv, that is the return, our motif we saw in our text today, for the return to the land, to home. Pilgrimage was a part of the average entrepreneur's life in the ancient world too. As James says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Some were comfortable in exile. Others, like some of you, ached and longed to be home, right? To be home. Are you familiar with George Carlin's routine comparing baseball and football? Where he compares the two. Some of you are, I know. We've gone over this. Let me give an abridged version of it. Carlin says, baseball is played on a diamond in a park. The baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, sometimes called Soldier Field or War Memorial Stadium. Baseball begins in the spring, the season of new life. Football begins in the fall when everything's dying. Can you tell which one he favors? Football is concerned with downs. What down is it? Baseball is concerned with ups. Who's up? In football, the specialist comes in to kick. In baseball, the specialist comes in to relieve somebody. Football has hitting, clipping, spearing, piling on, personal fouls, late hitting, and unnecessary roughness. Baseball has the sacrifice. Football is played in any kind of weather, rain, snow, sleet, hail, fog. In baseball, if it rains, we don't go out to play. Baseball has no time limit. We don't know when it's going to end. We might even have extra innings. Football is rigidly timed, and it will end even if we've got to go to Sunday. Carlin delivers it a lot better than me, Bob. And finally, the objectives of the two games are completely different. In football, the object is for the quarterback, also known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use a shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack that punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line. In baseball, the object is to go home. In baseball, the object is to go home and to be safe. I hope I'll be safe at home. So it is with any family man, right? So it is with any family man who has a happy home for which he longs. And so it is and should be with every one of you believers, too, fellow pilgrim. So it should be with every one of you believers, fellow pilgrim. There are times and moments when it is understandable, perhaps, that one might relish and enjoy the good things of life. That's much of the theme of Ecclesiastes, isn't it, too? These things are not contradictory. I'm not contradicting myself by saying you should long for home, yet relish the good things of life. And it's understandable that some of us might relish and enjoy the good things of this life yet for a little while and maybe say, Lord, come soon, Maranatha, but not maybe until June 16th or 17th, right? John and Yesica can't be blamed for wanting to extend their pilgrimage for at least a little while yet, or Ed and Bree, too, for that matter. Or I imagine it must have been sweet for John McNeely, for example, to be at the inauguration of the 9/11 memorial and see the fruit of his labors spring up in the fountains, right, that he worked so hard to complete. No one can begrudge him this either. But a theme and the motif in everyone's heart must be at some point, I'm not home. I am not home yet. I am on pilgrimage, a sojourn toward another home. Well, how can I be assured of this? How can anyone be assured of this, know that it is indeed real? Well, Paul says we walk by faith, not by sight. But he says much there, doesn't he? We walk by faith, not by sight. Now, for those dead in their sins, who have no life in them, this is foolish and utter nonsense, isn't it? One such man is Bill Maher, who has a chip on his shoulder for those of faith. Bill Maher has a cable television show, talk show, a very cynical person, but who can blame him in his condition and his state? Bill Maher says, faith means a lack of critical thinking. It makes a virtue out of not thinking. Believers just accept the teachings of Christianity on nothing more than blind faith, unquote. What else is a spiritually dead man to say? What else is a spiritually dead man to say? with a dead heart, blind eyes, and deaf ears. What is he to know, see, or hear? All faith looks like blind faith to a blind man. He's just being utterly honest, articulate in his death, isn't he? But not so you. With a beating heart of flesh, not of stone, with ears that hear the word of faith preached to you, with living eyes to see the Christ of faith, you know to your toenails that you have a home not made with hands, that you will put on a heavenly dwelling, to use Paul's language here in this text, you will put on a heavenly dwelling one day. Let not your hearts be troubled, Jesus says to us. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. So, you will soon or late be home. You'll be home. And you'll be safe. You'll be safe at home. You know this. You walk by faith, accompanied by the living presence of the Holy Spirit, too, and amply supplied for your journey, for your pilgrimage, with all things necessary. You have the Word, that is the record of God's faithful promises, right? God's faithful record, study it, and you will see in your faithful increase. You have the sacraments, that graceful nourishment for the dusty wilderness. And you have your fellow pilgrims. Look around you. You have your fellow pilgrims too. The living body of Christ himself, of which you are a part. But always know this, dear pilgrim. Your heart's longing is ultimately to be away from this tent and at home in your mansion. Union, that is, union in its fullness with Christ. And until then, Paul has some other advice for us in verses 9 through 10. Courage. Be of good courage. As the lion and said, courage, right? In, Yeah. Such a wizard I am today, huh? Courage, for good or evil. We will all be called to account. Thus, we strive for obedience. There is a constant in the Christian life. Whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please Him. We make it our aim to please Him, that is, obey. And there is here the blessed heart of obedience that does ring true in this text, doesn't it? The blessed heart of obedience that does ring true. It's not the cruel heart of a tyrant who lords it over an unwilling subject who must be driven with the chain and the whip to obey, right? Nor is it the easy lawlessness. The easy lawlessness of debauchery and decay where a careless father lets his kids get away with murder. Rather, this is the obedience of a son who loves his father because his father first loved him. By caring enough to discipline that son, you fathers, you know this, don't you? We make it our aim to please him. Such sons know what pleases their loving father because he has previously disciplined them. A father who does not discipline cannot love. Don't tell me a father loves his kids when he does not discipline them. Even though all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, as the author of Hebrews says, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Fathers who truly love their sons discipline them. Such sons who truly love their fathers then, in turn, willingly, lovingly obey, such that they aim to please him. It is a joy, not a burden. It springs spontaneously from a heart and will that is shaped for obedience. You live a life of shaped, tempered, constant obedience as a son. So, dear believer, this is a constant to which you will cleave through eternity as well. whether at home or away, we will make it our aim to please Him, both now and forever. Amen. Right? So, practice, practice, practice this obedience. You will live a productive, happy life as a Christian as you do. Additionally, you must be aware, I would be remiss if I did not bring this to your attention, like every good son, like every good steward, you will be called to account for what you have done while at home in the body. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. As a son, you will be rewarded for excellence, disciplined for disobedience. Would we expect anything less from the judge of all the earth, though he be a father to us? But wait, Pastor, you may say, you're creating all kinds of cognitive dissonance in my brain. I thought we were all saved by grace and beyond the scope of divine punishment and hell and suffering, God's displeasure, all that, right? I thought I was in scot-free. Now you're telling me I'm in for punishment if I don't obey? Well, this accounting is distinct from your acquittal at the great white throne judgment when the book of life is opened. That's a completely different scene. There you are found just in your Savior, where He claims you as one of His own. There you will be bidden, I am your God and you are my person. This accounting of which Paul speaks here is before a loving Father who by His nature expresses His love not only in blessing but also in discipline. Right? It will be nothing new by that time. Philip Hughes just has some eloquent pages on this. And if you're still confused between what the bema, that's the Greek word used here for the judgment of the judgment seat of Christ, what the difference between this is and what the difference between it and the white great white throne judgment is, Philip Hughes does just an excellent job. I quote him briefly here. He says, the tribunal of Christ, speaking of this one, the tribunal of Christ serves the purposes of absolute justice. It vindicates the holiness and impartiality of God. It is a salutary reminder to the Christian that, although it is true he has been justified by faith and is no longer under law but grace, yet the moral values of God's universe have not therefore ceased to be his concern. On the contrary, it is precisely the Christian on the fleshly tables of whose heart the law of God has now been inscribed, whose life should display the fruit of moral constancy. For this we will be held account. To account. And the degree to which you have done so will be declared by God. Here. The degree to which you have done so, been an obedient son, will be declared by God. Here. But as Hughes says again, the judgment pronounced is not a declaration of doom, but an assessment of worth. Get that distinction? The judgment pronounced here at the bema, at the judgment seat of Christ, is not a declaration of doom, but an assessment of worth. Paul expresses this with more fullness in other places too, doesn't he? For example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Let's turn over there for just a moment. You're in 2 Corinthians, go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Precisely the kind of assessment of worth he's talking about here, he expresses it with more fullness, beginning at about verse 10 of 1 Corinthians 3. According to the grace of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation, and someone else is building upon it. Let each one take care how he builds upon it. For no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, and precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become manifest. For the day will disclose it. This day of assessment that Paul is speaking of here in 2 Corinthians as well. The day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each has done. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. So you see, this is an assessment of worth. When the great divine assayer tests the metal of all of us. What will be your worth on that day? You must ponder it because you will go through that fire. What is your worth? What will the great assayer of metal declare you to be? This solemnly should temper all that you do here. We should therefore then live lives of integrity and obedience and productivity for your Father's kingdom. How should we then live, as Schaeffer would put it? Well, we should live lives of integrity, obedience, and productivity for your Father's kingdom. So keep your eye on the horizon, dear believer. Our God's kingdom comes swiftly and soon. In your pilgrimage, fellow pilgrim, in your pilgrimage, know that you're not yet home. You're not yet home. Regardless of your joys and your sorrows, your highs and your lows, your ecstasy or despair, you are not home. Do not become so myopic and content here that you forget about there. Pay it forward. Accumulate treasure there. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also, right? A missionary couple was disembarking from a ship that had carried them back to the United States of America after 30 years on the mission field. They were finally stateside for good. On board with them was an American diplomat who was returning from foreign service as an ambassador. There was ticker tape, a huge cheering crowd, and a military band playing rousing patriotic music. As the ambassador was swept away in a limo and the band marched off and the crowd melted away, the missionary husband heard his wife softly crying as they were walking down the gangplank. "What's the matter, sweetheart?" he said. She said back, "I'm just a little sad that there's no one even here to meet us after that lavish greeting for the ambassador's coming home." "Well, dear," he consoled her, "we're not home yet." We're not home yet, are we? So keep your perspective and your courage, dear believer, for we're not yet home, are we? Until then, let's whet our appetite for home, maybe, by eating of the body.